what living in Europe allowed him to do was when he got to Lower Merion as an eighth grader, that experience of having lived abroad made him open to other people and other potential experiences in a way that a lot of peers at that age aren't open to. Now, you know, keep in mind, Lower Merion has this, there's the stereotype of Lower Merion as this old money, you know, very waspy suburb of Philadelphia. And that's true to a great extent. But it's also very diverse racially, very diverse socioeconomically. And there were certain experiences that certain people who grew up in Lower Merion Township had that were distinct and different from everybody else's. You know, the black kids tended to live one way. The Jewish kids tended to live another way. The waspy Protestant kids tended to live a third way. Kobe could cut across all of those kind of demographics. He saw color less than most kids did because he lived abroad. He had lived in Italy. The family had been strangers in a strange land. So he comes back and he's able to make friends with just about everybody through basketball. Basketball is the vessel that kind of gets him into the culture of the school. And that turns him, by the time he graduates, into this point of pride for the entire community.
Hey, folks, welcome to the podcast. That is Mike Silski. He is a author of a new book about Kobe Bryant. Really, really fascinating book. And that's him sort of giving you a little perspective on what Europe and growing up in Europe did for Kobe and the kind of person it made him when he ended up getting to, middle school and high school in America. Really, really interesting conversation because it goes beyond just about basketball and really delves into what makes Kobe Bryant tick or made him tick, and just really cool conversation. Before we get to the full interview, please tell your friends about the podcast. We're making a push to get more folks listening. So please send the link to all of your friends and family. And if you don't have friends and family, please go get some. They're good. They're good people to have. Also, Delta sucks as an airline. I was supposed to go to the College World Series this weekend. My flight got canceled. It was 7 o'clock at night in June, 65 degrees out, no bad weather anywhere. And guess what the answer was, why there was a problem? Weather. Liars. 2.5 hours, stuck at the airport in LaGuardia. And there's actually a picture of me sitting on a chair I took from a restaurant, and I just put myself in a chair in a 2.5 hour line to talk to a customer service rep. It's on my Instagram page, at Paul Mercurio. And so they're liars. They wouldn't tell me the real reason. They didn't tell any of us. They canceled a whole bunch of flights. I couldn't go. Don't fly Delta. Don't fly. Just walk, scooter, ride a St. Bernard. Anything would be better than flying, especially with Delta. The worst. The worst. So I was supposed to go with my son and we missed it. And but still had a good time with my son this weekend. We broke into some liquor stores and stole some money. But that's just something we do, you know, as a father-son bonding thing. But I'll get into that another day. Anyway, enjoy this conversation with Mike. Great book. And please tell your friends about the podcast. And see you next week, everybody. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. My guest this week is Mike Silski. He is an award-winning columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, was named best sports columnist by the Associated Press in 2015 and 2001, has a great book out called The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality. Mike, it's nice to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul.
Yeah, absolutely. So I really like the book because it's hard to write a book about somebody who's written about all like a superstar like that. And that had to be daunting. And I want to key off the word immortality for a minute. John Madden, he passed away a while back, and in his Hall of Fame speech, they showed a clip about, he talked about immortality and that he didn't really believe in it. Although being in the Hall of Fame maybe gives you a little bit of immortality. I think, you know, that's important to some people. Was that, as Kobe became a superstar, important to him? I can't imagine as a teenager in Pennsylvania, he thought about that, or maybe he did.
He thought about it a lot as a teenager in Pennsylvania, actually. And that was really one of the more parts about doing the research and the reporting for this book. I mean, I think everybody knew how driven Kobe was to be a great basketball player and be a great athlete. But at least I didn't have an appreciation for how committed he was at so early an age to be the greatest basketball player in the world. I mean, this is a kid who didn't have much of a social life in a lot of respects as a high school kid. You know, his father played in the NBA and played professionally in Europe, and the family moves back to Lower Merion Township just outside Philly in the late fall of 1991. So Kobe's in eighth grade at the time, and he kind of drops out of the sky, and he doesn't have the background and the upbringing of virtually any of his peers. So how does he doesn't know like what the popular music is. He doesn't know what the popular TV shows are. He doesn't know what to wear. And basketball is what allows him to connect with his community and with his peers. And he just single-mindedly devotes himself to that. I mean, in eighth and ninth grade, he's talking about going to the NBA. And when he's 14, 15, 16 years old, he and a friend are driving around to playgrounds in and around Philadelphia. And the friend has two jobs. He is to rebound all of Kobe's shots and pass the ball back to him while Kobe works in his dunks and his footwork and all that stuff. And then he screams at Kobe things like, "You're not black enough. You're too soft. You played at a white school." All these things that Kobe was hearing already and would continue to hear throughout his teenage years, so that he could kind of put on that emotional armor to get himself ready to play better teams in high school and eventually, you know, compete at a high level in the NBA. I mean, that's the way this kid thought when he was 15 or 16 years old.
Was this all obviously, you know, it's nature, nurture, and, you know, so he's in an environment and he could have gone into a shell and ended up doing drugs or what, you know, at that age, it's such a hard age. We've all been that age or impressionable. Amazing that he used that and used basketball in such a positive way. I guess my question is, was the father behind any of that motivation to be great, to be an NBA great? I mean, obviously he played, and you hear about stories of, you know, parents wanting to push their kid to the next level that maybe they didn't get to.
Well, Joe and Pam Bryant, Kobe's parents, really more indulged him than they did push him. They didn't have to push him. He loved the sport from the time he was little. He always felt like his father had been kind of born too soon, to put a phrase on it. I mean, he was 6'9". He was a tremendously talented player, but he didn't really have a position. Coaches in the NBA didn't know what to do with him. He was a bit of a free spirit, and so.
Well, wait a minute. He was too small to be a power forward and too big to be a guard.
Yeah, they wanted to play him at center and power forward, but he had more of a guard kind of a game. And back then, before Magic Johnson came around, you didn't play a 6'9" guy at guard. So, you know, Joe wasn't real. He was a little bitter about how his career had gone. And Kobe saw himself as kind of, you know, working to redeem the Bryant name as a ball player. He also, from his mom, had this kind of tenacious, competitive, you know, attitude. Pam Bryant ran the household. She was raised a strict Catholic, raised her kids Catholic. The discipline that he had really came more from Pam, I think, than it did from Joe. Joe could advise him about what it was like to play in the NBA and what he needed to do to get there. But Pam gave him the attitude to get there. And so, you know, he had the motivation himself. You know, he watched his dad practice in Italy and would, you know, simulate the moves of the players and his dad, and they would play in the driveway and he would play by himself. And he was willing to do whatever he had to do, for the most part, to make himself great. His parents really didn't have to push him. It was all kind of came from within him.
Yeah. You mentioned that his personality was a quote, a breath of fresh air when he returned to America. He came to live in Lower Merion, and that he had a unique perspective on life, obviously growing up in Europe. And you just mentioned, you know, so how it sort of, he just was a bit of a fish out of water. What did he bring to people at that stage of his life as a young man coming from Europe? I mean, probably obviously more worldly. I mean, one of the questions I had coming into this conversation was, what effect did him living in Europe have on him becoming great? And you just answered that, which is really fascinating.
No, I was just going to say, I think you're raising a good question, Paul. And I think what living in Europe allowed him to do was, when he got to Lower Merion as an eighth grader, that experience of having lived abroad made him open to other people and other potential experiences in a way that a lot of peers at that age aren't open to. Now, you know, keep in mind, Lower Merion has this, there's the stereotype of Lower Merion as this old money, you know, very waspy suburb of Philadelphia. And that's true to a great extent. But it's also very diverse racially, very diverse socioeconomically. And there were certain experiences that certain people who grew up in Lower Merion Township had that were distinct and different from everybody else's. You know, the black kids tended to live one way. The Jewish kids tended to live another way. The WASPy Protestant kids tended to live a third way. Kobe could cut across all of those kind of demographics. He saw color less than most kids did because he lived abroad. He had lived in Italy. The family had been strangers in a strange land. So he comes back and he's able to make friends with just about everybody through basketball. Basketball is the vessel that kind of gets him into the culture of the school. And that turns him, by the time he graduates, into this point of pride for the entire community. You know, a community where there had been some tension kind of lingering for years and years, can all come together and celebrate this kid and what he's doing for the basketball program. They win the district championship. They win the state championship. A school that had never been known for basketball, or at least not been known for it in a generation, now becomes a basketball powerhouse. And it's all because of Kobe.
There's a bit of a paradox for me, which is, on the one hand, it totally makes sense to me. You live in Europe. You're raised in Europe. And your father has the kind of job he has. Like, you're going to have world life experiences that, you know, some people only dream about. And that allows you to sort of bring something new to the table in terms of relationships that other people don't when you move to a place like Lower Merion. But on the other hand, you say he was really only comfortable in his own skin in the world of basketball, and was how he connected to the community. Why wasn't he able to connect with the community in other ways, in a more traditional way that teenagers do, especially given that he had such a unique perspective on life and came from a pretty worldly life experience up to that point? You'd think it would be easy for him to not just need basketball to assimilate.
It definitely got easier. Yeah, no, it definitely got easier for him the longer he was there. You know, basketball was his way in. And then once he gets in, he figures out that he loves rap music and makes friends with certain kids who also love rap music. You know, he takes an honors English class and, you know, is a terrific student. So he becomes becomes very close to his 10th grade English teacher and becomes friendly with, you know, the high achievers academically at Lower Merion. Basketball is his way in, and he eventually does become the most recognizable popular figure in the entire school. But initially, he drops out of the sky in the fall of 1991, and it's kind of like, who is this kid? He's just real tall, and we've heard he's good at basketball and that his dad played for the Sixers. We don't know anything about
him. He speaks Italian fluently. It's like, it's this weird, combination of,
He's Italian in the hallways with his sisters when they pass each other. And it's like, it's almost like, you hate to use this word, it's almost like he's an alien. Like, where did he come from?
Yeah.
He's got to learn the civilization and the customs. But then once he does, he's completely assimilated.
It's so amazing. I mean, I always say, that's why I love talking to people from my show, is like, you can always point to something in somebody's past, yours, mine, especially in their youth, that portends what they will do and do well. Like Bob Costas talks about at Bob on, and he would lie in bed at night in St. Louis in Missouri and listen to the Cardinals games, baseball games, like 10 years old with a transistor radio. When anybody listening who doesn't know what a transistor radio is, look it up. And he said he could remember being more enthralled with Jack Buck's call of the game than the game itself, although he loved the game. And that's just your DNA, right? Like, that's just, you can't plan that. And this is another example of that. Like, that this is just this form, this being has been formed in a certain way, and that informs the way he interacts with people and what his life goal is. You mentioned talking about being informed. you said that, you know, you worked closely with Greg Downer, his coach at Lower Merion, in sort of writing the book. And then Jeremy Treatman had tried to collaborate on a book with Kobe in the late 90s, but he had some recordings from transcripts of interviews he did. And you said, quote, "They have informed my writing and reporting and made the narrative more detailed, more honest, and richer." How so?
Well, I mean, first of all, it was an amazing story that Jeremy, you know, had tried to write this book with Kobe. It hadn't come off. He couldn't find these tapes. He had transcripts of some of his conversations with Kobe. Couldn't find the actual microcassettes until December 22nd, 2020, 3 days before Christmas. He's cleaning out his garage and he finds a bag with the tapes. And he calls me up and I come over and I get the tapes and I'm able to listen to them. And to answer your question, listening to Kobe's voice, what he was saying, how he was saying it, his thoughts on, he provided details, for instance, of events that I otherwise wouldn't have known. For instance, Lower Merion plays a state playoff game his senior year. They blow out the other team from Scranton High School. And after the game, the entire Scranton team, all the coaches and players, line up to get Kobe's autograph. There's no mention of any newspaper article anywhere, but Kobe describes the whole thing. So, you know, I've got something like that. I've got Kobe's thoughts on his mom and dad and his relationship with them when he's young. I've got him, you know, dropping F-bombs.
What were his thoughts on his parents at that time?
They were a very, very close family. And the idea at one point, and this is made all the more poignant because, you know, the family did fracture in years thereafter. And really after 2001 to 2002, because of Kobe's decision to get married so young to Vanessa, you know, it just led to this disillusion of the family and their bonds. But at the time, the family was so close and Kobe so appreciated that he couldn't understand why somebody wouldn't want to be close to his mother and father. When he ended up with the Lakers, Joe and Pam lived with him for the first couple of years in Palisades in a house out on the West Coast. So, you know, there's a lot of that stuff. I mean, there's him telling everybody what he really thinks, or at least telling Jeremy Treatman what he really thinks about Del Harris, his first coach in the NBA. And he doesn't like him. He F-bombs him up and down for taking him out of games and not understanding how he plays and limiting him and all these things. So,
really? Wow.
It's thoughts like that. The tapes allowed me to get inside Kobe's head in a way that I never could have without them. And that I'm not even sure I could have if he had been alive and around for me to interview him, you know, when he was 40, 41 years old.
Because he might have been too guarded at that point.
Exactly. Yeah. And he would have had to travel back to when he was 17 or 18, you know, to think about it.
That's a great
and
point.
Maybe
like,
come up with something, opposed to
in the moment. Yeah. You got an in the moment diary, day to day. Yeah. That's a really good point as opposed to trying to recollect things 20, 30 years later.
Exactly.
You also said that, you know, it's because he had spent so many years with the Lakers, people thought he like sprouted out of the hills of Southern California, but there are aspects of his personality and life that people had forgotten or didn't know at all. And I wanted to explore those aspects. That all started to come. Had you not found those tapes, would you have been able? I know after his death, you were hit with the idea to do the book. Had you not gotten those tapes, would you have been able to write the book, or would you have been able to approach the book the way you did it? And what were some of those aspects of his personality that maybe people didn't know at all?
Sure. Well, I found the tapes. I was already well into writing the manuscript of the book when Jeremy found the tapes in his garage. So my manuscript deadline was March of 21, and Jeremy found the tapes in December of 20. So I had to quickly, you know, listen to all of them, process them, and then weave their insights into the narrative and into the story. You know, I think the way I looked at it was everybody in the Philadelphia area who is familiar with Kobe is generally familiar with that aspect of his life at Lower Merion. The young, you know, Philadelphia is almost like its own under the dome kind of entity. It's so parochial that the things we know well around here are not necessarily things that everybody else around the country or the world knows well.
No, and I relate. I relate. I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and I'm a huge Boston fan. And Providence and Boston are like that too. They're very much like Philly.
Yeah, exactly. So the good part about that was that there were a lot of people who were eager to talk about Kobe and tell stories about him and give their insights into him and experiences with him in a way that had never been revealed before. And it went beyond just his high school teammates and coaches. For instance, Kobe was involved in the Student Voice at Lower Merion, which was the school's Black student union organization. Nobody knew this. I didn't know this going into it. But the more research and reporting I did, the more people I talked to, the more I learned about, okay, he's grappling with his identity as a teenager. You know, what does it mean to be Black? And what does it mean to be Black at Lower Merion, which is not an inner city school, which is not a completely white school? Like, that's a unique environment. And what does it mean to him to grapple with his identity at that time of his life? So, you know, he didn't talk about that much on the tapes, but, you know, through the reporting and the research and going back to the Lower Merion Historical Society and all that kind of stuff, I was able to find those details and tell that aspect of his story, which I hope, you know, I know nobody's kind of delved into before, and I hope people find interesting.
Oh, no, it is interesting. The book is great. And there are also fun little anecdotes, like he showed up as a child at a rec league tournament with goggles that he didn't really need, but because he was a big fan of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and he had goggles on. Is that right?
Yeah, he wore goggles and knee pads. you know, he looked like you know, an Erector set come to life or something like that, because he had been around a pro player, and he had seen, you know, he'd watched Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, his sisters played volleyball, and they wore knee pads, so he thought he must wear knee pads. He would ice his knees and his joints when he was 13, 14, 15 years old. And the other, the men and the kids who he was playing pickup with were like, what is this kid doing? But Kobe had seen Joe do that. He had seen the professional Italian players do that. So he figured this is what I ought to be doing. And he just knew at an early age, in a way most of us don't, what he wanted to be and how he wanted to get there. And he was going to do whatever he had to do to achieve what he wanted to achieve.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I'm one of the things I've been curious about is, did he ever have doubt or lack confidence? You know, as an outsider looking in, you know, from all you read about and interviews you see, just, you know, and you're confirming this, like a very focused, from a very young age, driven. But and we all have chinks in the armor. We all have doubts and, you know, did you get a sense that he did? Did anything rock his confidence?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There was a moment, and he spoke about this on those tapes I mentioned. There was a moment before he's about to announce that he's jumping straight to the NBA from high school. You know, and if you watch that press conference in, when is it, April of 1996, he seems so confident and so self-assured. But about a week out, he has a moment that he confesses, he pulled aside his dad. And his dad, you know, he says to his dad, you know, can I do this? Is this really going to happen? And his dad says to him, look, you've been preparing for this every step of the way. You've succeeded in everything you've gone after. There's no reason to think that, you know, this won't work and that you won't achieve what you want to achieve. And it's that kind of moment of fleeting doubt. And that's it. He gets up there in that gymnasium at Lower Merion, and he is completely self-assured. It's almost like he's an actor or a talk show host. He's so confident in front of the audience. And, you know, he says, I'm going to take my talents too. And he pauses and puts his hand on his chin, feigning like he's thinking about this, like, oh, I don't know what my answer is going to be. And then just delivers it with this big smile on his face. And you watch that now in retrospect, and you're like, of course, this kid knew how great he was going to be. And it was just a matter of, you know, it was only a matter of time before he got to where he wanted to be.
Well, the book is terrific. It's called The Rise, Kobe Bryant, The Pursuit of Immortality. And by the way, I love the picture on the cover, because it's, you know, him, the shot of him from high school, and then it, with the 8 and the 24. It's a really, the cover does it justice. It really, you do get a sense of what the book is about just by looking at the images. So congratulations on the book. Terrific writer. Really love your columns. And great to have you on, and get you back anytime you want to come back on and talk about Kobe or anything else. It's Mike Sielski. Great to have you on, Mike.
Thank you so much, Paulus. I really enjoyed this.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. Mike was great. The book is terrific. And please spread the word about the podcast. I want more folks subscribing, and got a lot of great interviews, as you know, going back 300 plus interviews. So just let folks know. Thanks for checking out the podcast, and We'll see you soon.